Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. All right. I am your host, Nika Sherrell, and this is the It Cast, Real Talk on Sex.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Oh. Hello, everyone.
I gotta love the technical glitches, right? Okay. So welcome, everybody. This is the It Cast, Real Talk on Sex. This is our community outreach podcast that aims to increase diversity in conversations on health and sexuality. Through this work, we are creating a world where all people feel loved, honored, and respected. So I want to celebrate with you all for a second. It's been 1 year since we started sharing this work globally. Yes. And I just want to let you know that we are proud to tell you that we are making a difference in over 14 countries, 15 states, and an innumerable amount of cities, including Los Altos, Encinas, El Cerrito, San Francisco, LA, New Jersey, Dallas, Texas, and Seattle. And I also want to give a shout out to our international listeners out there. Hello to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, England, Indonesia, India, Mexico, and Venezuela. Thank you so much for being a part of this journey and continuing to allow this work to grow. This month, we are competing for a spot in the Bay Area Top Women to Watch small business owners. You can find out more about that on Instagram and tag us as Nika Sherrell. This March, we are hosting our second iteration of the Healing Power of Touch with Queen Mutima Imani. The Healing Power of Touch is a 6-week tantra series where we're going to go over white, pink, and red tantra. Please join us for that. You can post your questions and your comments in the chat during this episode or send them to nikasherrells.com so that we can answer them on the show. Support the ItCast and the work we do by visiting theitcast.com, subscribe to this YouTube channel, and share it with your community. So we've been sitting here excited. This week, we are talking about real talk on creating consent culture. And today in the booth, we have Marsha B. Hello. Marsha is an internationally recognized speaker, writer, coach, and expert on sexual communication, relationships, and women's empowerment. Since 2003, she has helped tens of thousands of people through her private coaching workshops and group programs. Her primary mission is to help women and the people who love them to overcome shame and get in touch with what they truly want. Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
I'm so glad to be here. This is great.
This is what I love about this is that it's so in alignment with what we're doing and what we are creating here on the It Cast and at Nika Sherrell's. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and what brings you to the show.
Well, a little bit about myself. So I grew up in Georgia in the 80s and 90s, which was not a particularly open place or time about sexuality. And I had two parents who lived together and were in a relatively happy marriage for a long time, but they were pretty conservative. But also my mom worked in social services. And so she was like, simultaneously like pretty Catholic, pretty Republican, pretty conservative, but she was also like very pragmatic and a nurse and working with, you know, pregnant teenagers and kids in the foster care system and issues of abuse and things like that. So I always give my mom a lot of credit, my dad too, but particularly my mom, a lot of credit on getting me started on the consent thing, because she was just very good with both me and my brother about like, you don't have to hug relatives just because they're your relatives. You, if there's ever something your friends are trying to get you to do that you don't want to do, you can, you know, tell them that I won't let you, just let me know what it is I'm not letting you do, so I don't out you to your friends. Like, I just always felt like my mom had my back in that way. And, and you know, I was a pretty headstrong child, so navigating like telling a kid that she has a bodily autonomy and then being like, oh, I need you to do this thing is like a tough tightrope to walk. But I really gave her a lot of credit for that. And started doing sex education as a teenager, actually, as a peer educator for HIV prevention. and then went to college also in Georgia, and then moved to New York City. And I was in New York City for 8.5 years. And while I was there, I co-founded an event called and workshop called Cuddle Party, which some of you may have heard of, which now has like, I don't know, 200 facilitators around the world, and is about, yes, it's about touch, but it's really a consent workshop. It's really about learning to ask for what you want. You get to say no. You do not have to do anything you don't want to do. And all of those things that I kind of got sort of in a, not with fancy language, just with lessons from my mom, like we kind of formalized a lot of that so that people had a chance to learn these skills and practice and not try to just do it in isolation in a high stakes situation, right. You know? So that's how I spent the 2000s. And it was kind of a weird phenomenon because, you know, I'd been teaching workshops for a couple of years at that point. But that was the one the media was like, New Yorkers are cuddling. What does it mean?
New Yorkers can't cuddle.
No, it was so funny. It's like, is this a 9/11 thing? Mind you, this was like 2004. So I don't know what that was about. And it was really interesting because we became international news in like 6 weeks and we were not ready for it. We had no idea it was going to take off like that. But it really kind of kickstarted this conversation about non-sexual touch, as well as, you know, how do you ask for what you want? How do you change your mind? What do you do if you're a maybe? How do you set boundaries? Like if you're a yes, can you change to a no? If you're a no, can you change to a yes? Like that kind of stuff. Yeah. So that really immersed me in consent, the beginnings of like consent culture. And back then, you know, we were starting to develop some nuance, but it was still a very yes means yes, no means no, which was still progress over what I was raised with, which right. was you don't talk about it at all.
No one talks about it. What do you mean? Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. I love what you shared about your mom with the whole conversation around personal agency and autonomy. Mm-hmm. We don't build that in to children such that when you get to the yes means yes, no means no conversation, that you're even clear on what that is for you. And I agree, like it's a very limited perspective mm-hmm. on what consent is. So I love that it's growing. And as it grows, like, tell us a little bit about your book. Yes.
And then okay, so that was what I was doing in 2000s. And then I moved to the Bay Area and I kept doing this work. And in, I think 2015, I was running a facilitation training for people who wanted to become cuddle party facilitators. And this woman, Erica Scott, came and participated and she became a cuddle party facilitator. And she loved the work because she was a childhood survivor of sexual abuse, kind of the exact opposite of my experience of childhood in that regard. And she was like, this is a revelation. Everybody should have access to this. But she and I both knew, and anybody who's been a cuddle party facilitator knows that a lot of people are really freaked out by the touch. Like they're just like, they don't believe us when we say you don't have to cuddle anybody at a cuddle party. And why would they? They've had their consent violated so much. You know, it sounds like a setup. It's not a setup, but if you've had that experience a lot, you would not necessarily be eager to put yourself in a potential situation like that. So she wanted to take this content and turn it into something that was more accessible for adults who didn't want to go to a cuddle party, but also more accessible for young people, where touch and consent, especially for people who are still figuring out a lot of this stuff or who are under 18 legally, there's some things.
Right.
And I was like, go for it. Take the content, like turn it, you know, experiment, like whatever you come up with. And then in 2018 or early 2019, she made a workshop called Consent Culture Intro, which the book is based on, which is based on my work. And then in early 2018 or 19, no, it was 19. She was like, I need to turn this into a book. And she messaged me. She's like, will you write this book with me? And I was like, absolutely. Cause I really want this to be out in the world. So we now have a book out called Creating Consent Culture, a Handbook for Educators. And it is written for people who are teaching or who are wanting to facilitate with young people. It's also very effective for adults. But my secret, the secret of this book is that the first third is for teachers and the second two thirds is for everybody.
Yes.
And you know, we talk a lot of important concepts in here.
Yeah, and it's very important for teachers and educators to actually have that knowledge, because from there mm-hmm. it ripples out. You know, yes, it's for everyone, and also the people who are developing and creating the mm-hmm. minds and the thought leaders, they need that.
Yeah.
And like so many educators are not trauma informed. They're not like, you fill in the blank. There's so many things that go into that. So I'm really grateful that we're creating this.
Yes.
Educators, it's powerful.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. You mentioned trauma, and we are trying to, I mean, it's, there's a lot of, the concepts are pretty dense, but the exercises are really fun. And we really wanted to make this fun and accessible, because people learn better when they're having fun. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we really saw when we were looking at other consent workshops for young people is that a lot of it's like, watch this thing and then let's have a discussion, which doesn't really get that somatic embodied, like I feel it in my bones that I know that I can say no experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted that. So we have a lot of like very fun, some of them are really silly. Usually there's a lot of laughter. Like it doesn't feel like we're delving into trauma, but in the content where we're explaining it to the teachers and the educators and the social workers and the parents, because parents are also going to be really into this. We talk about, you know, fight, flight, and freeze. We talk about the fawn response. We talk about ways that trauma can show up. And we also talk about power dynamics. Not just like, you know, boss and employee, but also sort of social power dynamics, race, class, you know, because kids are sorting all this stuff out and they're mimicking what the people around them are doing. And, you know, disability, I mean, there's so many education levels, like there's so many things, physical size,
right?
These are all factors in consent. And we're really trying to get this idea that consent is not just about sex. It's like bodily autonomy.
Thank you. Thank you.
It has to start way before that, you know? And that whole thing of like, parents are like saying, say no to sex, or say no to, you know, you should feel empowered to say no to people you don't want to, whatever. But then at the same time, they're forcing their kids to hug their relatives if they don't want to, or kiss them, or like, I mean, we talk about this in the book, even under the best of circumstances, like the most like caring, nurturing parents, we learn how to go along with things happening to our bodies that we don't want mm-hmm. before we can talk. We get our diapers changed when we don't want to, we get picked up when we don't want to, we get put down when we don't want to. So we all have this internalized going along with and tolerating things happening to our bodies. So we have to do some active counter programming on that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those mixed messages can be really hard, but if we can at least create little pockets where we can learn, it's, in my experience, it's been very helpful for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah. It actually like hit me in a very physical way when we were talking about children not have, like, you know, so many things happen to your body that you have no control over. Mm-hmm. And I think about things like corporal punishment and like mm-hmm. physically reprimanding our children, like that, it creates so much separation from your physical self and your mental self.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and it's taken me many, many, many years. Like I follow my intuition, which is really just my body saying, hey, this doesn't work, or hey, that sounds like fun. And it's right. Like, I wouldn't know that if I were still dissociating and disconnecting from who I am.
Yeah, and it's corporal punishment. We talk about in the book, we talk about the dominant culture is a culture of coercion. And it's everything from corporal punishment and abuse and retribution to name calling. We're telling kids not to cry, like to just get over their, like to ignore their feelings, basically. Or to, you know, sit down and shut up, you know. And it's not that it's a, you know, consent culture is agreements, it's collaboration, it's not a free for all. So that, but it's that treating each other as in an age appropriate way with like, you have input, you have some autonomy, and you know, little kids, this is written for kids over 10. So, well, it's written for adults who are working with kids over 10, but it's also like extremely applicable to adults. And, you know, the reason we're not working with younger kids in this is because of developmental stuff. But by the time kids are starting to be tweens and teens, you know, it's appropriate to have more bodily autonomy. And it's very inappropriate to just be forced to comply just because some adult or somebody bigger or somebody with more social power says so.
Right. Right. And we get into those conversations at a very young age, mm-hmm. you know, like the popular kids and, you know, mm-hmm. all this interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I love what you're talking about with power dynamics. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things that I recognize is that people don't quite understand what is going on with power dynamics and why consent is something like it'll come up later, like, oh, well, I didn't feel like I consented to that. And it's like, there's mm-hmm. a bigger conversation over the power dynamics and the ability to communicate mm-hmm. when you're really paying attention to it. So can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Yeah. We could talk for days about that. So we do talk about power and privilege in the book, and we do it in a way, again, that is, you know, fairly accessible. We hope is accessible. There's a little wheel in there that sort of looks at a lot of different power axes, right? So like there's race and there's disability and class, but there's also like physical size. Age is something a lot of people don't think about. You know, in our culture, very young and very old people have a lot less bodily autonomy and are accorded a lot less respect than middle-aged people. Middle-aged people are sort of the powerful group. So our access to these things can also change over the course of our life. Gender is obviously also another sort of aspect of this. What part of town you're in, you grew up in, accents or part of the country, you know. I'm blonde, Southern, Polish, and a woman. Like, I can't even tell you how many different ways people have tried to tell me I'm stupid over the course of my life.
I love when they're like, oh, you're so articulate.
Right. And these little microaggressions that add up and kind of make it so that it feels hard. And the thing is like culture making, you know, culture creation, which is what we're talking about in this book, it's not a monolith, and we can't just wave a magic wand overnight. But what we can do is create warm, safe havens for one another where we can, you know, I didn't feel like I could speak up. I didn't feel like I could say no. I hear that all the time. I don't know what I want because no one's ever asked or cared.
Right.
Right. But what we can do is in our interactions with one another is pause, is listen, is ask. You know, we can do these things for one another. And, you know, yesterday I was being interviewed and so they asked, well, what can people who are in a position of power or privilege do? So like in a sexual context, usually in a heterosexual context, there's certainly like the man woman dynamic. And I've worked with so many female clients who've just assumed that the men, it's just, that's what the expectation is.
Right.
It's his desires and needs just are prioritized. But even beyond that, there's like in a kink dynamic, like so many submissives feel like they can't speak up to their DOMs. And so many, there's a lot of wonderful DOMs out there, but there's a lot of people who are abusers who use that as an excuse. And so in terms of what we can do, like, it'd be great if we all had like really thorough trauma awareness with fancy words, but we don't all have that. I mean, you don't really need it to do consent well. What you do is things like, tell people it's okay if you say no to me. I'm not going to get mad. No. Or even if I'm disappointed, I'm not going to punish you for it.
Right.
Or withhold, or, you know, those kinds of things. We can literally ask, what do you want? And if they don't know, give options of what might sound good. Another thing that, especially in like a kink context, when I'm teaching consent and with those kinds of power dynamics, I really encourage the dominant in the negotiations to make a proposal for what they're going to do. Like, okay, so I think we could do this. Like, we've got a date scheduled, like, you know, let's do these activities in this time frame, whatever, but to always include something that you're pretty sure that you're not into to see if they will say no to that. And if they don't, highlight it and bring it to their attention, because there's a few things at play. One is when people feel threatened, there are three autonomic responses that are common to all mammals. And we talk about this in the book, fight, flight, or freeze. You may have heard of these. Mm-hmm. A lot of people only heard about fight or flight, but freeze is the most common response to sexual assault. And it is also the thing that is most common to happen again if you've experienced it once. So that feeling of like, I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. I just froze or disassociated or whatever. So that's a really common animalistic, instinctual, automatic thing that happens. And then there's the fawn response, which is a learned trauma response, where I don't want to rock the boat because I don't want to have the bad thing, whatever I think that is, happen to me. So I'm going to people please and be a doormat and all of that.
Yeah.
When we know that these, that freeze and fawn are two things that could happen, we know to pause and check in with our partners. And it doesn't have to be a whole elaborate thing. It's just like, hey, are you still with me?
Yeah.
And those are things that people who are in a more dominant power position can do, especially if, you know, there's somebody who is marginalized or who's carrying a trauma background, or if you just don't know your partner very well, those are really good things to do.
Right.
And it can be done in a fun and sexy way. I have a download on my website about how to do this in a fun and sexy way. That's free on my Asking for What You Want website. But all of this is to say, you know, power and privilege absolutely come into it. It's not that you can't play. It's that you have to be conscientious and be thoughtful and be caring and recognize that most of us, because we've all grown up in a culture of coercion, have places where we're not good about asking for what we want or saying no or changing our minds.
Yeah.
And so when we create those warm, safe havens where those things are normalized, it has a ripple effect into our lives. That was a very long answer, but I told you I could respond for days.
It was perfect. Oh, and I love, you said a lot of things that I love in there, but when you got to the part about your partner being in a marginalized body, mm-hmm. it's like, that is so real. And people aren't necessarily present to that, whatever the conversation is. There are things that aren't present on the surface, you know, like neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, like certain disabilities. And it's like, mm-hmm. to be able to share that in that space of like creating consent and having that conversation, it's like granting someone agency, mm-hmm. granting them the ability and the right to choose over their body. Mm-hmm. I think that's, yeah, that's incredible. So talking about, you put in the book, like the maybe, the whole, like the importance of maybe.
Yeah. What do you do if you're a maybe?
So, you know, outside of the fawn and freeze context, like, how does that relate actually?
Yeah. So maybes can come up for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes we need more information about what's going on. Like you asked me if we could go to a movie, but, I need to know how long the movie is. So I know if I need to get back to, you know, for the babysitter or whatever. Like sometimes we just need more information. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're a yes to part of it, but not a yes to the whole thing. Like I'm a yes to you, but I'm a no to the activity. Or I want to do something, but not that. Right. And so that can be a confusing sort of internal experience as well. My sort of go-to advice with maybe is if you're a maybe, say no, because you can always change your mind later. And a lot of times people think they have to have a reason for their no. And so we start with no as a complete sentence, and we have a whole bunch of fun little exercises on how to get more comfortable saying no. But we've all been in that situation where we kind of need more time to figure out like what's going on. Like it's like spaghetti, it's like soup in there, spaghetti soup in our heads about whatever's on the table. And it's like, well, I like you and I trust you to have some intimacy, but I don't know if I have enough trust built with you yet for that activity. Or it could be, And to explain all of that is complicated.
Right.
But to be just like, no, I need more time. And the thing that I always tell my clients is, all you need to look for is like, does this feel better or does this feel worse?
Yeah.
You don't have to have the answer. You just move. If you're continually moving to the things that feel better, it's better. Like, it does, right? You have to have the fully formed verbal, this is what I would like. And then I would like this. And then I would like that. And then I would like this other thing.
Right.
We think we have to pre-negotiate a lot of this stuff. But the truth is kids are really good at consent, actually. And they're good at the sort of on the fly co-creation. Important sidebar on the co-creation, if I may.
Yes, please.
So I do want to pause and take a couple steps back and define what I mean by consent, because the model that we're using is not the gatekeeper model that a lot of us have been taught, where one person asks and the other person says yes or no. They're the gatekeeper. In a sexual context, that's like based on, I don't know, 1950s sexual politics of like, there are only two people and one is a man and one is a woman, and the man wants the sex and the woman has the sex and he's trying to get it from her
all the time.
And she doesn't have any desires of her own. She's only allowed to say yes or no. There's so many problems with this model.
Is she allowed to say no?
Oh, well, in the 50s, you had better be able to say no. Well, you were an impure woman, right? Like, that's there's this whole virgin whore thing. There's so many challenges with this model. The gatekeeper model of consent is better than no model of consent. You know, at least people are asking and saying yes or no. And it is relevant in, for example, like legal contexts and medical contexts and things like that, where there's one person who is taking an action and the other person is, like, if you're submitting for a permit to for your house, that's pretty much a gatekeeper model, but that's not sexy. And this is the thing that a lot of people don't get about sexual consent, is that sexual consent is sexy because we're shifting from the gatekeeper model to a collaborative model of consent.
Right.
Both people put their desires on the table. Both people put their boundaries on the table. Both people, you're navigating it as you go. You're checking in, you're asking. And like I said before, kids are actually really good at this. Let's play tag. Okay, you're it. No, I don't want to be it. Okay, you're it. Okay, I'll be it. Okay, that's base. Well, this other thing is base. Oh, now we're playing freeze tag, you know?
Yes.
And you kind of like work it out as you go, and you say things out loud, and then people either agree or disagree.
Yeah.
That's consent. That is a collaborative model of consent. We all could do this as kids.
Yes. I love it. And you know, like, it's a game. It's a game. Like, let's set up our game. Mm-hmm. Let's set up the parameters. Let's go have fun. And one of the things that I think is happening as we become adults is like, there's a lot of shame for what we want. Like, well, I want that to be based, but I can't tell them, or, you know, all these different things. And what you said earlier about being willing to say no, or being willing to like receive a no, and letting people know that like, it's okay if you say no. Mm-hmm. These different places inside of us where as we age, it's like, it's harder to communicate. It's harder to say, this is what I want.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say too, if it's a gatekeeper model of consent, a no is a rejection. But in a collaborative model of consent, a no is information.
Interesting.
So if we're like putting everything we want on the table and looking for the Venn diagram overlap, it's sort of like we're sorting out that's in, that's out, that's in, that's out. And, you know, one of the things I'm always, again, this is not in the book, this is more adult, more of an adult thing. And I do talk about this in my free download, is, you know, ask for a lot more than you think you can get. Because if you accept that no is part of, is information, if you ask for more, like what most of us do is we don't ask for what we want, we ask for what we think we can get. So that means we ask for 30% of what we actually want and we get 10% of it.
Mm.
And so we're constantly like feeling shame and lack and scarcity. But if you ask for say 100% of what you want and your partner's like, no, so in the first example, they're no to 20% of what, you know, but in the second, they might say no to a lot more stuff and you might get a lot more stuff. So if you're relating to no as information and you're putting more stuff on the table, and you're not relating to no as I asked for the wrong thing, and you're not treating your partner as a gatekeeper, you're treating them as a collaborator, It becomes easier to hear a no, because it's like, well, I got a no on that, but I got a yes on all this other stuff. So cool, let's go do that, right? And that's, you know, there's still shame, there's still challenges like wrapped up in this, but it is a fundamental shift in how we relate to asking, to boundaries, to yes, to no. And it is a lot more fun, honestly. Yeah. Like, you're getting a lot more no's and a lot more yeses. So if you're fixated on the no, you're still going to probably have a problem, but that shift to, well, we're collaborating and we're seeing where the overlap is. And like, we're figuring out what sounds good for our time together. Yeah. How do we want to share space? Let's create an agreement about how we want to do this.
I love this. I created this, this way to gauge and like share what you like. And so, so I call it the table game.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so like, so like, you know, like you're putting your cards on the table. And so it's like, hey, I like this. I put it on the table. And then you decide if you want to pick that up or not. And it's like, yes or no. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to it. And then they put something on the table and then it's received in the same regard. It's like, does that work for me? Does that not work for me? Mm-hmm. And even though it can be a little challenging to show your cards, it moves through so much so quickly. Mm-hmm. And you get this like nice, healthy list of like, these are all the things that are fun.
Right.
Both of us.
And there's apps that do similar things. I've seen a couple of apps out there that have a similar, like, you only see each other's answers if you're both a yes.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, there's like, I love that idea of literally putting it on cards and then putting it on the table. That's so great. I love that so much.
Oh my gosh. So there's so many ways. There's so many ways to actually create this. And okay. There's an aspect of me that's actually like rectifying this gatekeeper model, because it's so like familiar. It's like, well, what do you mean there's this other concept? And so my first thought was like, oh, well, like the women are the gatekeepers. And I'm like, that's super heteronormative. And I'm like, the person with the body, like that.
Anybody can be a gatekeeper is the thing in the gatekeeper model. If somebody wants something and they're first of all fixated on it, or second of all, that's the only thing, because they're only asking for what they think they can get or the thing they want the most, and they're not paying attention to the whole gamut of desire, of their own desire, they're giving this other person power. But the flip side of having that power is you're not allowed to have any desires of your own. Right? And so there is, you know, it can play out in so many ways. Like when a person's body is fetishized, when you're fetishized, you're also not really an agent and allowed to have your own desires. You're just a stand-in for somebody who thinks that object is hot, right? Or so like the sort of very obvious example is this heteronormative thing, but it could happen, you know, women to men, it can happen women with women, it can happen across racial lines, gender lines, like all over. There's infinite numbers of ways people have figured out how to either be just shitty to one another, or who figured out how to like objectify or like just narrow their experience because they're afraid or ashamed, you know. And I have a lot of compassion for that, like it's scary stuff. But when we see the other person as a full person, then they're no longer the gatekeeper. And I see a lot of people sort of treat their partners like, well, they're the ones that say yes or no. I'm like, what do they want?
Right.
What are the other things that you could be doing that both of you would be finding fun that you're not even talking about?
Right. Yeah. And then, and that's still the fascinating thing, is that's actually still collaborative. When you're like responding to your partner as the gatekeeper and they're responding to you, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of like blame and tension on both sides. It's nasty.
It's just not, I mean, it can be hot if it's negotiated.
There you go.
But when it's not negotiated, it frequently becomes a place where couples get bogged down with, especially like higher desire partners and lower desire partners. You see that a lot, where the lower desire partner just becomes this gatekeeper and is frequently afraid to initiate because it might lead to sex, and they don't want sex, but they might want closeness, but then they don't initiate closeness. And because the question on the table that's always unspoken is, are we going to have sex? Are we going to have sex? Right. Are we going to have sex? And, you know, there's some people doing some great work on high desire, low desire partners, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, where it's like, well, let's schedule opportunities for sex instead of scheduling sex, or let's specifically have time where we're naked together and we are not going to have sex, or let's, you know, say like, when I'm initiating affection with you and it's a weeknight, like I'm not initiating sex, please know that, like, or just even kind of creating space for that affection and intimacy and connection to exist without the fear of that one question and the gatekeeping coming into it. Yes. This is very far outside the context of the book, but it isn't in terms of, you know, application and implication.
Yeah, I mean, and we're creating a culture of these conversations. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a lot more, like, I'm sure you could write a library of books of all the things that, you know, like that we're working towards. Yeah. And one of the things that you said is like the higher desire, low desire partners. I'm so glad that you shared that. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of couples where it's like, there's a frustration. It's like, you're not giving me what I want. You don't want what I want. You don't love me. Like, it's a deep, deep rabbit hole. And looking at that, what I'm hearing is like, when it comes to sexuality, there's higher desire and lower desire partners. But in general, I'm hearing different desires.
Yeah. Like,
I desire intimacy and affection versus I desire sex and, you know,
mm-hmm.
thank me. I don't know. That's still affection.
Right.
But you know, like there's those different approaches, those different desires. And I don't think that we see those as equivocal.
What do you mean?
Like when we're talking about equivocal. Like in the concept of lower desire, higher desire, affectionate and intimate is not as important as sex.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's so many higher desire partners who are out there who are like, I don't bring my desires to my partner because I don't want to put them in that position. There are also a lot of higher desire partners who are badgering their partner. So I don't want to characterize it as any one way. Like there's a lot of ways to handle being in those situations. And there's a lot of ways to handle it that are still not very fun for anybody. Yeah. Right. And I think, I mean, this, in a couple's dynamic, especially if this is an entrenched thing, you know, that might be a therapy conversation. That might be where you need to get a third person in to help you sort out like what exactly is going on here. But if I were to offer one thing, is put more options on the table than whatever the thing is that you're sort of entrenched about. Like, take the thing that you're entrenched about off the table, but put a bunch of other options in, so that you can see at least, like, if it's not ideal, then at least it could be better. My whole philosophy is better is better. If it's better, then it's better. And like, you can incrementally improve rather than on and off switches of like, we are either having sex or we're not having contact.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think that's also a dissociative thing. Like, I've had partners where it's like, if you touch me, that means you want sex. And I'm right. Like, that can be equally as much of a dissociation as you touch me and I don't want sex.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Well, and obviously a lot of my career has been about taking apart that connection of touch and sex. And, you know, Western culture is a very low, American culture, I'll say that at least, is a very low touch culture. And yet we're primates and we need touch. Mm-hmm. And so we try to cram all of our touch needs into a sexual relationship when probably we should be like hugging our friends and, you know, climbing in piles of, you know, other kids or, you know, other adults or, you know, getting massages or, you know, just really having a lot more opportunities, brushing each other's hair, you know, and a lot of us live alone. I mean, especially during the pandemic, we've really seen people's touch deprivation. Well, what happens with touch deprivation? People are irritable. People are higher, their cortisol levels go up. Like, there's a whole biological thing that happens when we don't get enough touch, non-sexual touch in particular. But when sex is the only sort of safe or acceptable channel to get your touch needs met, it can really cause a lot of problems. You know, I coached a couple one time that were thinking about opening up their relationship because one partner wanted more something. They were like looking for the something more. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the problem is sometimes we're like, we don't know what the thing is. We're like, we want something more and we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And when we really unpacked it, what we realized was that partner had been the primary caregiver for their kids. The kids were older. They used to have a lot more affection with the kids. And it had just organically gone out the window as the kids got older and weren't around and were, you know, exercising their own bodily autonomy. And so they got a dog, because actually what they needed was, that was actually the answer was, I need a critter to like cuddle with.
Yeah, affection.
You know, and it's like, we think that these things, when our only answer for touch needs is sex, it doesn't occur to us to like cuddle our friends or hold hands with, you know, our bestie or to get a dog.
Okay, so this might be a side note, but
totally fine.
What I'm hearing is this actual conversation around like puritanical ideals is actually pushing us into a more hypersexual culture.
It's true. It's true. The irony of it is that don't touch anyone because it'll lead to sex makes us a lot more sexual and makes our sex less good because we're trying to get too many needs met in too small of a container. Like, sex is awesome. I am a fan. I love a good romp. And sometimes what you need is somebody to hold you. Sometimes what you need is somebody to flirt with you. Sometimes what you need is somebody to pat you on the butt. Sometimes you need to be tied up and left alone for a little while.
Yes, yes.
And when those are all options that are available, you can start to like choose off of a menu instead of being like, I guess sex is the thing we're doing. And now I'm like cranky about having sex because I'm trying to get something else. Met.
Right. Yes. Oh my gosh. That's so funny because I've shown up to sexual encounters with a whole like plan, like
right?
There's a script, there's an outline.
And like PowerPoint projection,
right? Like, we're gonna do all these things.
Yeah,
this is the time that I have it. So yeah, that's okay. So I want to talk. You mentioned something about context and how that changes consent. So can you share a bit about what that is?
Oh yeah. So context and meaning are really important for figuring out what we're a yes to and what we're a no to. Also known as our boundaries. So for example, a lot of times we negotiate based on activity because why not? Like, do you want to, you know, go to the movies? Do you want to get tied up? Do you want to, you know, have sex? Like whatever the thing is, do you want to get dinner? But context matters a lot. So if I'm feeling really rushed because I have a deadline at work or because I don't have childcare or whatever, it's going to be a different experience than if I have all the time in the world, right? And similarly, like who's doing it might really matter. So for the example I always love to give is like, imagine you're getting this amazing like scalp massage and the person who's doing it really knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now imagine that the person who's giving you a help scalp massage, who really is doing a great job and knows what they're doing, is your partner.
Okay.
Like, that's cool, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now imagine the person who's doing a really good job and really knows what they're doing is a random stranger who just started doing it to you on the bus. It's not the activity there that matters. Context matters, right? And the meaning that we attach to things like also matters. So context, one of the easiest ways that I have found to negotiate for really anything, but like particularly how we're spending time, sexual encounters, that kind of thing, is put a time limiter in. What do you want to do tonight? What do you want to do for the next 20 minutes? What do you want to do to me for 5 minutes? Other contexts, like if you're kinky, putting out a few toys and being like, pick one, like limiting, because if you ask somebody, what do you want? Like, I don't know, world peace, a sandwich, like What's the scale here? How much time do we have? Like, who's granting these wishes?
Oh my God.
Right? But if you put in some limiters, like, what do you want for the rest of the interview? What do you want tonight? What do you want this weekend? You know, even time, or what do you want to do? You know, here's three options. Which one is appealing? Like, do you want Thai, sushi, or Korean food? I don't know. I guess I want Asian food tonight.
Sushi does, you know, sound good.
Putting in some context, putting in some limiters really helps people narrow down what they want and also figure out if they have enough time, if they have enough attention, if they have enough energy. You know, the whole like let's play tag example, well, you know, it's going to last like at most till the end of recess. Probably it'll be like 10 minutes.
Right. Till the energy runs out.
You know, I think when we talk about our desires or when we talk about our boundaries, our no's, sometimes we're afraid to say anything because we're afraid if I say yes, it's forever. If I say no, it's forever. And by saying yes to something or saying no to something, you're not signing a contract. You're not obligated to do it until the end of time. You're allowed to change your mind, which we have a whole chapter on in the book too. So having, you know, being able to either pre-limit it up front or put context, like add context to your negotiations. Like, yeah, I'm totally up for, you know, a round of rope, but like my leg's bothering me. So like, let's only do it for 20 minutes.
Right. Or only this section.
Right. Exactly. Or, you know, only in the context of at an event or with a teacher, because neither of us know what we're doing or whatever. Another thing that I like to use as context, and this is not in the book, but it is in the free guide on my website at askingforwhatyouwant.com, is instead of asking, hey, do you want to do blank? There's also, do you want to try blank?
It's a very different question.
Or instead of do you want, you can say, are you willing? So it's a really, there's four questions. Instead of saying, do you want to do X? You could say, are you willing to do X? Do you want to try X? Or are you willing to try X? Those are really different questions that might elicit really different answers.
Right, right.
Like, are you willing to try this for 20 minutes? Is a really different thing than, do you want to do this?
Right.
Like, there's a lot of times. If I'm a maybe, I don't know if I want it, but I might be very enthusiastically willing to experiment.
Yes.
If you're asking me if I want it, I'm like, I don't know. I don't have any experience with that. I have no idea. And also, what if like I try it and I don't like it? And is that bad? Like, yes. can I get out of it if I, you know, so changing even the questions we ask.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, do you want to try this?
There's a lot of things I don't want to do, but I would totally like try it. Like that's...
Yeah, it's not something I think about. It's not a desire I have. I've never really thought through the logistics of it. I don't know if I'll like it. But if you're into it and I like you and we've got the time and the space, sure, why not? Let's see how it goes.
I love it. One of the things that I have that I've shared is, you know, when it comes to consent, make sure you have all the information. Make sure mm-hmm. you're sharing all the information, like mm-hmm. such that consent is actually present. In like all regards. And what I love is that we're also bringing context into mm-hmm. that. You know, it's like, yes, the information is important and context is important. Context is decisive, like literally.
Mm-hmm. Ah, literally.
Decision on context alone. Yeah. Without having all the information. And that's, you know, like those are also really important eye-opening conversations to have. Okay, so do you have any other oh, go ahead. Yes.
Oh, I just want to piggyback on that. You know, I think people hear that, like share all the information, and they think that means share it all up front. But our experiences change. We get tired, we get hungry, we find another thing that seems really fucking fun to do. like I got an idea. Sharing how things are changing for you as you go is part of sharing information. And not all of it has to be verbal. There's ways you can set up nonverbal communication. Again, that's in the free download ebook on the Asking for What You Want. That this is for kids, that's for adults, and how to make it sexy. or just for teachers of kids.
Really. Teachers who teach kids.
And adults, but that's a non-sexual. But for if you want to figure out how to do this stuff and actually have it be sexy, go download my free guide on asking for what you want. But that whole, I got so busy doing the plug, I forgot what we were talking about. you can do that. You can share in a nonverbal way also. That nonverbal communication is part of consent communication. It doesn't all have to be words. And that's particularly important for people who are like, who go nonverbal during sex, or who have, you know, verbal or auditory processing stuff, like sometimes, or it's loud in the venue that you're playing at, if you're in a public place, you know, having a squeeze system or a thumbs up, thumbs down, or an object that you hold on to.
I love that you shared this one, because that's a very sticky situation to be in. Like in the gatekeeper concept, it's like yes means yes, no means no. And I'm like, body language is important. Yes. And we've used that to, you know, like blame the victim and oh, they blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But if you're reading and paying attention to body language, mm-hmm. you can see and get a lot. You know, like, I believe you actually, go ahead. Yeah.
Exercises in here about that. There's two. One is the incongruous yes and no, which is one of my favorites, where we have people ask questions that, you know, like you're pretty sure they're really going to be a yes to, but they have to say no. Can I give you $1 million? Will you let me clean your house? Like stuff like that. They have the rule of the games. They have to say no. And then we switch it and you ask questions where you're pretty sure they're going to want to say no, but they have to say yes. And it's a hilarious exercise, but you really get that opportunity to see in yourself what it feels like to say yes when you mean no, or no when you mean yes. But it's also an opportunity for other people watching. That's what it looks like when it's incongruous.
Ooh.
Right. So that's one exercise. And then we have another exercise. There's a chapter called When is the Hug Over? And it's we talk a lot about nonverbal communication and body language and how one person, it only takes one person to not consent for the consent to end. Just because somebody else wants to keep it going doesn't mean it keeps going. Everybody has to agree to be there. And so that nonverbal piece, you know. Yes, it's super important in a non-sexual or in a sexual context, but again, teaching it in a really obvious and easy and fun and hilarious way where like, ooh, I know that one. There's that kind of laughter of self-recognition, but also being able to see other people learning it and have that non-verbal communication occurring. Like, you know, if I step away, if I put my hands between us, if I, like, I give an example of like the hug that lasts too long and how to get out of it. What are ways that we can communicate in non-verbally and to watch for also?
Right. That last one is so critical for mm-hmm. me. It's like to be able to notice when someone's not comfortable with a situation. And like, some of the things that we're taught are like, you know, like ask till you get a yes, and like, you know, all these other things, and it doesn't work.
Well, as somebody who does sales for my business, I don't buy that.
Right.
That it doesn't actually make for better relationships with your clients either. So it's that started as sales advice, and I think it's terrible sales advice as well.
Okay, we're not going to start slamming sales advice because, again, days.
Days.
Oh, I love this. I love this. So I can't express enough the context around like being able to listen. Yeah. When it comes to consent, it's like there's all this conversation of like be able to talk and use your words, and on the other side it's like be able to listen and receive and get that listen when nothing's even being spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wanted to say was on the whole context, you talked about fetishization mm-hmm. earlier, and one of the things that came up for me is like that in itself is expletive. Mm-hmm. You know, and if someone doesn't have all the context to that, then there's a breakdown in how they would relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is not to say people cannot engage in consensual fetishization, but that's a very different beast than non-consensual extraction.
Right. Like, I like having my feet played with, and I'm not going to stick them against somebody who doesn't like that.
Right.
Or, you know.
Yeah. We're like, you want me to be a bimbo? Okay, I kind of like being a bimbo. Sure, well, like, let's play with that. Which is really different than just being treated like a bimbo.
Right, right. Oh my God. Okay, I love this. Please share with us all the places we can find you, your book, any other tidbits that we need to know.
Yeah, so you can get the book if you go to our publisher. That's the best place to buy it, which is jkp.com. That's if you want to like support us. Everybody's like, where's the best place to buy it? Our publisher is the best place to buy it. If you feel like giving money to Amazon, please do that. You can buy it wherever you want. I just want you to buy it. But if you do it on Amazon, you can write a review there, and that really helps us out a lot too. So if you want to buy on Amazon, consider writing a review also if you like the book. And my co-author's website, which has all the book information, and we're putting together some study guides and fun things, is creatingconsentculture.com. Very easy to remember. It's the same as the title of the book. And my website, if you want to get the field guide to consent, which is about how to make consent conversations sexy, and that's free, and it's a PDF and an audio, is askingforwhatyouwant.com. And you can find me on the internet, basically on my handle everywhere is Ask Marsha B.
Love it. Love it. Thank you so much.
This was great.
Yes. I love all the work that you do and the resources and just the fact that you are contributing to the world in this way. No, thank you.
Thank you. It's a very fun and satisfying way to participate in the world.
Yes. Getting what you want.
Sometimes, often. In fact, the more I ask, the more stuff I get.
That part. All right, everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us today. The ITCast is our community outreach podcast that aims to increase diversity in conversations on health and sexuality. Through this work, we're creating a world where all people feel loved, honored, and respected. Please send us your questions, your posts, your comments to nikasherrells@gmail.com so that we can include you in the show. Check out our Instagram contest with Solish Magazine, and please feel free to tag us and join us this March for the Healing Power of Touch 6-week Tantra series. Ooh. Yeah. Get in touch with all the things.
We were talking about touch and how important it is.
Please support the ITCast and learn more about our work at theitcast.com. Subscribe to this YouTube channel and share with your community. Thank you everyone for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Bye everyone.
Excellent. Hey.